Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. We gather here around the electronic campfire on what is an auspicious celestial occasion. Did you get outside tonight to check out the lunar eclipse? If you are listening live, and if you live in North America, and if you don't have a lot of cloud cover where you live, you can still get a glimpse of it. It's still underway. Spectacular. Eerie. Awesome. I mean, any full eclipse is pretty cool, but it just so happens this one occurred on what astronomers call a super blood wolf moon. Super blood wolf moon sounds like something I'd make up just to sound spooky, but no, that's what it's called. Seems like a portent, right? Should be a harbinger of something. The title of a slasher movie, maybe. And with a name like that, something big should happen tonight. You know, a night for skinwalkers to prowl or werewolves to howl and strange things to appear in the skies. Well, we'll do our best to live up to the mood of the occasion and are glad you're here to howl along with us. You can't look anywhere these days without seeing something about UFOs, television programs, dramas, documentaries, radio shows, evening newscasts, podcasts. It's everywhere. Saturating our brains. I don't know if it's UFO overload, but sometimes it feels like it. And the stories about secret studies like ATIP, the TTSA venture, the rumors of big things to come, lots of scuttlebutt out there and a lot of pushback too from people who don't want any of this to be true or don't like it because they're not part of what's unfolding, so they dump on it. I've seen that with these new the History Channel series, Project Blue Book, this drama. Quite a lot of snark from the UFO crowd about this show because, you know, gasp, it's a drama. It's a scripted program. It's got actors in it. It's not word for word, minute by minute recitation of exact events. It's not a PhD dissertation. It's not a scientific paper. It's a television show based on real events, based on them. I'd advise people to chill out a little bit. But, you know, when you survey the landscape, what's unfolding in our world, the temperament of the times, you know, no one wants to chill out about anything. Everyone's got a gripe about something, and everyone seems to have a gigantic chip on their shoulders just daring someone to tip it off, and that is true in the UFO world as well. You know, I've not had a chance to sit down and watch the entire first two episodes, but what I've seen looks pretty good. Very X-Files kind of vibe to it. For millions of people who might just now be learning about Project Blue Book, the real thing, I think the program is valuable. It's not a documentary. It's a tool, though, for familiarizing the public with some of the basics that we talk about on this program a lot, that there really was a secret Air Force study, that they tried but failed to explain away all these UFO cases and incidents, that the project ended, Blue Book, that is, but secret studies did not. Timely news in light of the claims by the Pentagon that a more recent secret study of UFOs, ATIP, also known as AUSAP, ended years ago. It's all done. They didn't find anything of interest, so they ended it. Well, that's what the Pentagon says. It didn't end. The study continues. I don't know what they call it now, but it's still underway despite the denials and these statements from Pentagon spokespersons. And maybe we'll be able to chat about that tonight because both of our guests this evening will be at least nibbling around the edges of Blue Book and what the government knows. Coming up in the second half of the program, one of the best documented but least heralded UFO encounters of all time, Falcon Lake, 1967. A man named Stefan Michalak came face to face with a mysterious craft that had landed in a remote area, and this encounter changed his life in profound ways. That also spilled over in his family's life as well. Michalak's son, Stan, has collaborated on a book about that incident and the fallout. His co-author is a science writer and investigator, Chris Rutkowski. They put together a thorough and entertaining and well-grounded account of that incident, and more importantly, what happened afterward to Mr. Michalak. That's coming up a little bit later. First, though, how many times have you heard the old chestnut from UFO debunkers about how UFO true believers are just chasing flying saucers in an attempt to find God? That their search for aliens is really a search for the supreme being, a substitute for organized religion, or maybe it's supplanted religion, taking the place of faith to fill a hole in their otherwise shallow, empty lives. You know, the intersection of religion and UFOs has been explored before, and we've talked about it a little bit on this show. Tonight, though, we take things to an entirely different level. Dr. Diana Walsh-Pasulka is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She spent the last several years immersing herself in UFO study, looking at it from the perspective of a religious scholar to see if we are, in fact, witnessing the birth of a new religion. But I think after reading her book, I'd say that what she found is maybe bigger than that. Her vantage point, looking at this intersection of UFOs and religion and technology, is explained in this new book, American Cosmic. And it's populated with many names that you and the audience will know very well from listening to Coast, iconic figures in this field who have shared profound lessons along the way. Dr. Pasulka joins me momentarily, and I've been looking forward to this for months, ever since I learned about her book coming out. Webmaster Lex Lonehood and I have pulled together our usual assortment of items and oddities culled from various media sources around the world. We call it Naps News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast website. Look for a big, spooky photo of a full moon taken through some tree branches, illuminated by a light of a campfire. That's what we call a scene setter, folks. That is a photo that was taken in the middle homestead of Skinwalker Ranch on a full moon last March. Among the stories we have tonight, in case you did not read the New York Times piece about the Project Blue Book TV series, we have it. And I'm not here to plug the show. I don't have anything to do with the show, but I wanted to mention this story because it was written by two of the three journalists who worked on the blockbuster report December 2017 in the New York Times about ATIP and Lou Elizondo. They put the TV show into the context of what is unfolding around us right now. It's a good piece. Leslie Kane, our colleague, is one of the writers. As a corollary to that story, we have a new piece written by Lou Elizondo himself, which looks at the meaning of paranormal. Basically, he thinks, you know, everything is paranormal until it isn't, until we understand it in scientific terms. And he thinks one day UFOs and related phenomena will be better understood and will no longer have the aura of what some people would call supernatural. Also, a profile piece of cosmologist and astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell by an excellent writer named Larry Lowe. Also, a story about a string of strange deaths. I think it was mentioned on the program last night. The story should sound familiar to some of you because our friend Dave Politis wrote about it. Wrote about this weird mystery and these strange disappearances in one of his recent Missing 411 books. This article takes a different slant on that mystery. That and more in tonight's Naps News. And while you're on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day, gives you access to a vast archive of previous programs. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want, on just about any device. You can likewise subscribe to George Norrie's television show, Beyond Belief, which includes many of the guests and topics that are covered on the radio program. And you can find information about George's schedule of public appearances. He's back out on the road soon, maybe coming to a town near you. You should check it out. With that, let's assume the position. It's way too cold for your dog and cat to be outside, so bring them in, give them some chow, put on a pot of Joe, slide into those flannel jammies and bunny slippers, plop yourself down in a comfy spot or the Barca lounger, turn down the lights and turn up the radio because we're about ready to rumble in a moment. American Cosmic, a journey of discovery with Dr. Diana Pasulka. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Diana Walsh Pasulka is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religion. Her research focuses on religion and technology, including supernatural belief and its connections to digital technologies and environment. Her new book, American Cosmic, includes a lot of names of iconic figures in the fields that we talk about on this program often. And this book has been praised as being nothing short of spectacular and intriguing. And I would have to agree with that assessment. Diana, welcome to the program.
Thank you, George. I'm happy to be here.
I was curious what you set out to do, what the thesis was when you started down this road, and how that changed over the course of the next couple of years. I mean, I would have to think it would change a lot considering what you learned and recent events. I mean, wow, the timing is great.
Yes, it is great. George, thanks for being such a great reader of my book. What you said was, I look at the connections between religion and UFOs, and the book is considerably much bigger than that. And that's exactly what happened. So, first, I have to say a bit about what I do. So, in religious studies, a lot of people, even colleagues in history and people at the university, are unaware of people who study religion from an academic perspective. And there are, a few thousand of us in the United States, and we're not theologians or we're not ministers. And some of us are religious and some of us are not. And basically, what we do is we have academic tools, we have PhDs, and we look into the ways in which people practice their religions as, beliefs. And we don't come down on the side of whether or not God exists or not. We leave that to philosophers of religion. So we look at religious practices and that type of thing. And so I had written a book on purgatory, the Catholic, I'm a Catholic historian, basically. And I set out to do a couple of things in the book. The first thing I wanted to do was to show how our new environment, which is digital, a digital environment, screens, technology, has allowed for a new type of what I would call a religiosity to emerge. And just like the printing press created and helped the Protestant Reformation, or the invention of writing thousands of years ago changed society. So what I'm looking at is how new technologies change how we exist. And I was particularly looking at religious belief systems. I also wanted to address the idea that UFOs today inspired the same sort of experiences that members of other cultures experience with respect to non-human intelligence beings like angels and even demons. And Jacques Vallée had pointed this out in Passport to Magonia in 1968, which is an excellent book. So I, these were the two things I set out to do. What actually happened, I did do those things, and I started this research in 2012. But what actually happened was that the book, in a way, and the research really took my life over. So when I think of my research, you can even see it if you look at my publications. I'm, pre-2012, post-2012. And my life is completely different now. So when I studied Catholic culture and I studied, beliefs that Catholics from, say, the 1800s had, I never ran into scientists. I never ran into people affiliated with the government. I never had the kinds of experiences, some scary, that I had while studying that stuff. So as soon as I got into the territory of studying UFOs, the landscape changed completely, and I found myself in a really, really weird research site, basically research area. I went to New Mexico. I ended, up in the book going to the Vatican, and I met a lot of people. Early on, I met Jacques Vallée, who mentored me and helped me think through these kinds of things. Jeff Kripal, an inspiration and mentor as well. And there were times when I decided I'm not going to do this anymore. It's just too weird. And something would pull me back in. So I'm glad you understood that and saw that this was something that and the book is described, it's an Oxford book. It's published by Oxford, which is an academic press. And I wrote the contents of the book, but the descriptions of the book are edited by my editors, and they don't necessarily describe the contents of the book. So a lot of people read it and they go, oh, this is just, somebody who's reducing UFOs to just this mythology or belief. And I want to say, no, it's not. Actually, I want you to read the book. It's different than that, because my original descriptions were actually edited quite Well, let's just put it this way. They were edited a lot to the point that they didn't look like my descriptions anymore. So there was that. One other thing before we go on to some other questions is that the dividing ufology, you had mentioned this, between, you know, what's normally called the nuts and bolts people who are interested in kind of, you know, let's apply the scientific method to this thing and find the physics of the craft and how they, you know, the propulsion and how they work and everything, is often put into, it's versus the more religious oriented, some would say woohoo aspects of the phenomena. And what I found was that as I got into the issue and I talked to scientists who actually worked with the phenomena, that this issue is actually a false dichotomy. You can't actually,
yeah, they're not mutually exclusive.
No, they're not at all. I mean, you can't really separate these out. So I tried my best to explain this in the book as well. And actually the characters, a lot of the characters in the book, some of who are anonymous for good reason, it has to be, you know, these are scientists who are at the top, they're well-known scientists at the top of their game.
I wanted to know if you would call this a transformation for you. And I say that for this reason. It's a, you know, it's a steep learning curve. I remember when I started, and I've talked about this before on the program, so I apologize to those who have heard it, but, you know, I was thinking to myself, well, this field is a mess. And what it needs is a good reporter, and give me 6 months and I'll have this all figured out. And of course, you know, it's 30 years later, and I may know less now than when I started, because it really leads you in so many different directions, in unexpected directions. And I know it changed the direction of my life in very distinct ways. And I wondered if that is accurate in describing what's happened to you.
Yes. I think, you know, John Max, the person who made this well-known in the 1980s and 90s, and the Harvard professor, called it the epistemological shift or the metaphysical shock, right? And no doubt I had that. I had that when I started, Chris Bledsoe, actually an experiencer, lives near me. And so he and I became friends. My family befriended his family. We know each other. We would have dinners together. And so I got a, kind of like an inside view of the life of an experiencer, as well as, I mean, I've been studying religion basically my whole life, and I have the tools to study weird stuff, you can say, right? So, you know, what do you have in religion? But a lot of weird stuff. You have, you know, people walking on water, you have angels, you have demons, you know, we're talking about all traditional religions in some ways have these weird things, and we study them. So I already had the tools to study them, but the tools that I had were ones that I used for historical things, for things that are in the past, for things that I didn't necessarily believe in. And when I began to, Chris's son went to my university, so we had occasion, Chris and I had occasion to talk all the time. And I met many people that he knew. And I guess what happened was that I met also scientists would show up, and they would want to basically talk to Chris. And in a sense, and not just Chris, but experiencers in general. So by this time, you know, this is about two, you know, I'm pretty gung-ho about my research. So within 2 months, I knew many, many experiencers. And I met another group of people around the experiencers, and I called this group the meta experiencers because they were experiences, some of them, but not all of them. But what they were doing, they were scientists, some affiliated with government, some not, some affiliated with institutions, and they were using this information that the experiencers had for technologies. And some of these technologies were well-known technologies that were effective. And so this is, I think, what started to really cause me to shift my perspective, my life view, my life perspective. And it was quite radical. It was quite uncomfortable, but, you know, exciting. I mean, it was a lot of different things. At the time as well, I was working with the screenwriters and the producers of The Conjuring. And so the screenwriters could tell, because I was helping them with their script, it was, you know, about Catholic culture, they could tell that something was going on with me. And so they would say, What are you studying now?
Diana, I'm going to ask you to hold there for a second. We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to get into that, talking about your work on The Conjuring and how it affected your views and set you on the road to American Cosmic. We're talking with Dr. Diana Walsh-Pasulka about her new book, American Cosmic. Among the adventures she had in the course of putting this book together over a seven-year period, she had to be blindfolded, put into a vehicle, taken out to a remote desert location, supposedly the site of a UFO crash. I'm not sure I'd be willing to do that, be blindfolded by people I don't know and taken out into the desert, although I suspect a lot of people have wanted to do that at times over the years. We'll be right back in a moment to hear that story.
Boy, it's going to be a fun 2019, especially if you're a fan of the live theater experience. Hey, everybody, producer Tom here, and we're going to kick off the year with a live stage show on Saturday, March 23rd in beautiful Everett, Washington. Come see George Norrie interview live and in-person special guests Peter Davenport, the director of the UFO Reporting Agency, esoteric researcher Johnny Enoch, afterlife expert and near-death experiencer Daniel Brinkley, and we round out the night with rogue scholar and prophecy expert John Hogue. Come meet George Norrie, myself, and all the guests at the meet and greet immediately following the show. Complete with a live band and audience participation, this is one night you don't want to miss. For tickets and information, you can go to the Coast to Coast AM website in the events section, or you can call 425-258-6766. Come on out and have some fun with us. Call 425-258-6766 or go to coasttocoastam.com. That's coasttocoastam.com.
Welcome back. Diana, you had mentioned among your accomplishments academically, you're viewed as a Catholic historian, a historian of the Catholic Church. And right before the break, you mentioned something that was also included in the book, American Cosmic, that you had been an advisor to the movie, The Conjuring, and I think the follow-up movie as well. It makes me wonder then if you are viewed by some of your colleagues as like a closet weirdo.
Well, maybe the math department thinks that, but people in my field are used to this type of thing. So maybe not closet. You know, I could be out.
Was there any pushback when you told your colleagues there that this is where you were heading? This is the road you're heading down.
For the UFO book?
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, that's an excellent question. You know, I call this thing that happens to people who are, usually legitimate, established professionals that decide that they're going to study UFOs. A lot of times what happens to them is that they experience a lot of pushback, like you say, and sometimes it destroys their careers. And I call this the John Mack effect, because John Mack was audacious enough in the 1980s, he was a research psychiatrist at Harvard, and he had won a Pulitzer Prize, a fully tenured, full professor, you know, seemingly untouchable, and he decides he's going to study the population of people who are experiencers or contactees. And so Harvard decides it's going to do a investigation of him. And this lasts for months and months. He has to hire an attorney to defend himself. So I call this the John Mack effect. Now, when I took on the UFO topic in my field, we go up the ranks. So we're like lawyers. You know, there's the junior partner, you know, and then the junior partner, the associate partner, then the partner. So I made partner. So I became a full professor. And I was the chair of my department and tenured. So I was well aware that this could definitely, this could definitely impact my credibility. But at that point, I felt that we were far enough from John Mack that I could do this. And I've had maybe one or two colleagues, you know, say, oh, what are you doing studying UFOs? How trivial. And this happened last year, actually. I was invited to apply for the chair of astrobiology. It's a NASA and Library of Congress position. And I had an astronaut and several, you know, well-known people write letters of recommendation for me. So I basically asked him, has NASA ever asked you to work for them? And he said, no. And I said, well, look, they just asked me. So I actually was shortlisted, didn't get that position. But, you know, I think that now studying UFOs, I mean, almost 50% of people believe in them. I believe that this is a legitimate study now. I mean, of course we have to study them. We know now, and probably will learn through the Project Blue Book on TV, that there was management of perception, you know, perception management in the 50s, 60s, 70s, perhaps even today, of the topic. And, you know, that a lot of that perception was that, you know, don't study this. You know, if you are a legitimate researcher, this will ruin your career. And I never tell my young students to study this topic unless they do have tenure somewhere. You know, they can study it as a hobby. They can I can help them study it, but I won't tell them to take it on as a, you know, a field of research, because, you know, they do have to be in a pretty secure position to do it.
Well, I mean, yeah,
we're
there
not
are risks.
Far from John Knack.
You found out early on, and you mentioned in the book, is that this thing called the Invisible College, that's the term that Jacques Vallée has used for it, that there are academics and serious scientists and professional people who do study this. They try to do it quietly to offset any potential downside to their careers, but they're very serious in the research.
Yes. Okay, so I did. I found what I called the meta-experiencers, which were the scientists who study this. And I also found that it's shifted from when Jacques and Hynek created, or, you know, the term the Invisible College. They didn't create it. That was a term that was, I think, Francis Bacon from his era. Basically, this college of studying science, you know, basically science that is fringe, you know, on the frontiers. And these are people who, you know, I mean, we're talking, you know, you put the great picture of the Copernicus, of Kepler's looking up Copernicus, you know, these were people that could have been in the Invisible College, you know, because Copernicus's book was banned, right? So I found a lot. But what I had to do was I read the whole history. I read Jacques. He gave me a copy of the Invisible College at the, you know, and said, read this. And so I read it. I've read everything by him, by the way. And so, yes, the Invisible College, it exists, but there are different compartments of it now. And there is a compartment that I'm basically talking about in my book, which I'm calling, I basically open it with a quote from Fight Club, which is a movie that it was a cult classic in the 90s and or maybe the early 2000s. And it's basically about this this man and a person who he's a friend of. And this person seems just incredible, almost like, you know, it's played by Brad Pitt.
And this and the first rule of Fight Club is?
Do not talk about Fight Club.
Right.
And so what I found was that this rule applied to this quote-unquote Invisible College. So, no, you know, in the Invisible College that Jacques was a part of, that Hynek was a part of, at least they could talk with each other. But I found that within this new group of researchers, the code, do not talk about it, was basically so serious that one could lose one's job if one talked about it. So I had to basically rethink what this was, and it was no longer the Invisible College, but these were the people who were making the most inroads in the study of it. And so that's why I referenced Fight Club and don't talk about it. The thing that they study is this thing they cannot speak of.
Let's talk about the trip out into the desert.
Yes,
give us,
I like
give
what you
us
said
a lowdown how that came about and
yes.
What it was like as you're blindfolded and what you saw when you got there.
Okay, so I had met a lot of the meta experiencers, the people who are scientists but can't talk about what they do, and a lot of them seem to be pretty. I actually, at this point, I think Well, I don't think I know. I basically told Chris Bledsoe too. He was, you know, we would talk about these things. And I said, Chris, I'm out. This is just way too weird for me. You know, I'm a normal, boring religious studies scholar. I have kids, I have a family. I'm not going to study this anymore. And he was sad, but he said, okay, right. So there were these scientists who were interested in my own work. And I thought, how could they be interested in what I did? Until I realized that they were interested in the historical record of aerial phenomena and the people who were associated with aerial phenomena. And I had access to that. So I pushed these people away for a long time, and I kept them on the periphery. I didn't meet them in person. And one of them had access to a place in New Mexico that was the site, the alleged site of a crash, an alien crash.
And not Roswell, though. Not Roswell.
Well, it wasn't Roswell, but it was apparently, and this is what it was told to me, there were several crashes in 1947. And they all happened within New Mexico in various places. And so this was one of the crash sites. And this person asked me to go because he said, you know a lot about the topic, even though it's not, you don't call it this, you know, you don't call it UFO study, but you have a lot of knowledge about it. And I'd like to take you to this place so you can have a lot more knowledge about it. And I put him off for about a year. And then finally, you know, at one point I said, I will go, but I will take someone with me. And because no, I'm not going blindfolded with a person, you know, that perhaps is dubious, I don't know, into the desert, you know, to do this. No, I have my, you know, that's like my line in the sand. And so he said, well, maybe, you know, I have to check it out. Who do you want to go? And okay, the first person I asked, and I think it's okay if I say his name and he's all right with it, is Jeff Kripal, who's a colleague of mine. He's a professor of religious studies at Rice University.
And yeah, we've had him as a guest here. He's a brilliant guy.
Yeah. Okay. So I asked Jeff, and Jeff said, Diana, that's just a little too weird for me. And I thought, you know, it is really weird. So I had just met another colleague, an academic, who is, again, at the very top of his field. He's a scientist at one of the big universities, incredibly respected person. And so fascinated with the topic. And so I said, you know what? This is the kind of person that this other scientist would actually want to meet. So I asked, and I call him, I write about both of these people, by the way. The first one who takes us to the site is Tyler, and I name him after the main character in Fight Club, Tyler D.
And Durden.
Tyler Durden. The next guy is James. And so James is the scientist, and I tell Tyler, I say, I'd like to take James. And he says, no. You know, it's sorry, no one else is authorized to go, just you. And so I said, okay, I'm not going to go. And then I knew that he would Google James and find that this is the perfect person to go because of his skills. And so again, a couple days later, he writes back and says, okay. And so we both go, James and I both go. We're blindfolded in the car. I trust James, he's an academic. You know, he has the same kind of academic transparency and rules that I do. I'm not yet trusting of the other man, but he seems, you know, on the surface, he's incredibly accomplished and successful and nice and charming, you know, all of these things. So we go out there. It takes about 45 minutes after we're blindfolded to get to the place. And we get out there and by the way, we have to wear a lot of protective clothing because apparently there are a lot of rattlesnakes out there. So we're wearing boots, we're wearing kind of parkas because it's really cold, but the sun is out there. So we've got, you know, we've got to protect our skin. And we go out there and we take our blindfolds off and we look around and we do find, and oh, we also have.
What were your expectations, Diana? What were you told is going to happen out there?
Okay, so my expectations at this point is that are that I'm basically interested in why these incredibly successful scientists believe this, because at this point, I'm not believing it, right? So I don't buy it, but I'm okay. I study all kinds of religions and people believe in all kinds of things, and I don't have to buy it in order to study it. So they know that too. You know, I'm really very open with them and say, you know, I'm writing this book and you know this, right? And I'm not necessarily a believer. And they say, yeah, no problem. So James and Tyler hit it off because they have a common scientific language. And we have metal detectors to find what's out there. And to tell you the truth, when I took off my blindfold and I looked around, Tyler looked at me and said, I kept looking at this area. And he said, does that look familiar to you? And I was like, well, how would he know that looks familiar to me? Because I've never been here before. And I said, it sure does. And he said, yeah, that's the scene in the last episode of the new X-Files. I was like, what? So, I mean, it was just the weirdest experience. It was very surreal. And he said, yeah, they may have had an insider in their on their team. And so it just got weirder from there. So they had metal detectors configured to the specific type of thing we were looking for, which I called artifacts. Because to me at this point, these are like religious artifacts to these people, and this is like a sacred site for them. And so we find some of these artifacts. It takes us all day. James finds some artifacts. I'm with Tyler. We find some artifacts. And
I think you wrote in the book that it had been littered with other pieces of metal, presumably by someone who wants to make it harder for anybody who comes out there looking for pieces of the artifacts to find it.
Yes, this is absolutely true. So the way the place looks is this, is that it looks like it's eerie and beautiful. And there seems to be rubble about 6 inches deep everywhere. And I asked about that. I said, what is this? And Tyler said that after the crash, the government goes through the whole place. And then what they do is a couple years later, they don't want anybody to go out there and find anything. And, you know, this is the 1950s now. And what they do is they put a bunch of aluminum cans out there. They just, and this is in the middle of nowhere. So they litter the place with, it looks like, thousands and thousands and thousands of cans that have now decomposed into this rubbly type material. And so that's what it looked like. And believe it or not, that part of the book was going to be edited out. My editor was going to take that out. And I said, well, no, you can't take that out. That's actually important. And, you know, she's like, why is that important? It just seems like a strange thing to say. Why would somebody do that? And I realized that, well, somebody did it. I don't know why they did it. Okay, can we just leave it in? Because to take it out would be something that would be inaccurate. I mean, I don't know. Let's just say that I don't know why they did it, but they did it. So we can't take it out. And so that she was okay with that. So we kept it in. So, So it looks like a place that had been managed, gone through all kinds of things like that. We did get the artifacts, and they're held in a place. They've been studied, things like that. So, and you know, the news is all about a lot of these artifacts now.
Yes. Yeah. So,
I'm not saying anything that anybody doesn't know who's interested in this topic. Go online, look at Jacques Vallée talking about these kinds of things. Look at, you know, TSA is talking about these things. I mean, these things are now being talked about.
You are being careful, and I think for a good reason. And we're going to get into that a little bit in the next hour. We're talking with Dr. Diana Pasulka about her journey of discovery that led to this book, American Cosmic, UFOs, Religion, and Technology. And we'll be right back. More to come on Coast to Coast.